You're listening to The Murder in My Family, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime,
DNA ID,
Three Men and a Mystery,
Zodiac Speaking,
and All Things Crime. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the podcast, its host, or sponsors.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit themurderinmyfamily.com for more information.
You can support this podcast by visiting patreon.com/themurderinmyfamily. This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'm your host, Mike Morford. In this episode, we'll be discussing the case of a 24-year-old mother of two who should have enjoyed seeing her kids grow up. Instead, she was shot to death and left to die slowly before being tied to a transmission and thrown off a bridge. We'll dive into this case after some quick housekeeping. Independent podcasts like this one depend on word of mouth to bring in new listeners. So if you find that you enjoy this show, please take a minute to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast, and be sure to introduce a friend to the show and invite them to listen. With your help, The Murder of My Family can continue to grow and reach a new audience. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderofmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @murderofmyfam, or by searching for The Murder of My Family podcast on Facebook. If you'd like to support this show through a Patreon donation, it's always appreciated. And you can do so by visiting patreon.com/themurderofmyfamily. Benefits of supporting the show on Patreon include early access to ad-free episodes of the show, plus bonus content not heard in regular episodes. Support may also include thank you cards, stickers, and more. If you prefer to, you can also support the show through a PayPal donation by visiting paypal.me/themurderofmyfamily. In each episode, I'll give shout-outs to any new supporters. In this episode, I'd like to thank Kellyanne Voice. And thank you to all the supporters that generously donate to help keep the show growing and improving. One last note. Please consider supporting any of the sponsors that you hear on The Murder of My Family, the way that the sponsors support the show. It's with our sponsor support that the show can go on and continue to provide a platform to share these stories with you in every episode. Thank you. And now on with the show. Deborah Lynn Jacobson, or Debbie as she was known to family and friends, graduated from Fairfield, California's Fairfield High School in 1982. She was so smart and such an accomplished student that she skipped a grade and graduated at the age of 16. The oldest of three girls, Debbie and her younger sister Miles were born in Michigan, but she grew up in California where her youngest sister Sonia was born. At the age of 18, Debbie got married and soon after had her first child, a daughter named Laura. 3 years after Laura was born, Debbie had a son, Gary. Debbie divorced her husband when she was 23 years old after about 5 years of marriage, and then Debbie took a job at Kaiser Medical, where she was a medical technician. It was then that she met and started dating John Christopher Smith. The pair eventually moved in together, but the relationship was far from perfect, and Debbie tried to keep her troubles private. On October 22, 1989, Debbie vanished. Just a week later, her body was found floating near the San Mateo Bridge on October 29th. She had been shot in the head, and police quickly ruled her death a homicide. Debbie's boyfriend, John Smith, was arrested for her murder, and later, a 25-year-old man named James Carter DeCamara, a friend of Smith's, was arrested on suspicion of being an accessory after the fact in helping cover up Debbie's murder. Early on in their investigation, police believed that Debbie had been murdered in San Leandro before being driven about a half an hour to the San Mateo Bridge, where her body was then dumped into the water of the San Francisco Bay. John Smith claimed that he and Debbie had a stormy relationship and that he wanted to reconcile with his ex-wife Linda, who had recently given birth to his son. Neighbors who lived in Debbie and John's apartment complex confirmed that the two did argue violently, quite often. According to John, on October 22nd, he and Debbie argued as their relationship was coming to an end. Debbie piled all of her things in one spot, stating she was moving out. John said he was glad because he could return to his wife and young son, but Debbie got angry and told him to leave. John gathered his things, including two of his guns, into a pile on the living room floor. But as he tried to pack his belongings into the car, Debbie would bring them right back inside. They both threw things at each other, and finally, Debbie wouldn't allow John to leave the apartment, grabbing him and hitting his back as she yelled things like, "What are you doing to us?" Again, all of this is John's account of what happened. All John claimed to have remembered after that point was the sound of the gunshot and Debbie falling. He claims he panicked and then drove to his friend James DiCamara's house and confessed that he had just shot Debbie. But rather than call for help, the pair went back to the apartment to figure out how to hide what John had done. They started by driving to the San Mateo Bridge with the gun that John used to shoot Debbie, and they threw it into the water. Then the two men drove back to the apartment and carefully wrapped Debbie's body in a tarp, and they anchored it to a car transmission. From there, they drove back to the San Mateo Bridge and threw the tarp and its contents into the San Francisco Bay. John and James then went back and cleaned up the bloody apartment. But the two men weren't finished yet. John and James next asked James' roommate, who had no idea what the pair had done, to help move Debbie's things out of their apartment. And he thought it was odd that she would leave things like her bronzed baby shoes, photos of herself and her children, and a Bible behind. John explained to the roommate that Debbie didn't take the chance he gave her to collect her personal items. The manager of the apartment complex that Debbie and John lived in testified at trial that near the end of October, John informed him that Debbie was gone and that he had to move because he could no longer afford the rent. The landlord said that John suddenly changed his mind and decided to stay, but he moved most of his items out and left a note on November 2nd stating that a certain person had permission to take things out of the apartment. Believing that the unit was now vacant, police were able to search it and quickly build their case against John Smith. Had Debbie's body not become separated from the tarp and transmission used to hide the crime, investigators, although suspecting her boyfriend of a murder, might not have been able to prove it and therefore might not have ever arrested him. At trial, multiple witnesses testified that Debbie wanted to leave John, but that she was afraid. These statements were argued on appeal as hearsay, but multiple people claimed that Debbie told them that John threatened to kill her if she left him. She also told people that she was definitely going to leave him and moved out in the middle of the night. She thought that was the best way to leave, without him knowing, so she wouldn't get hurt. Other people said that Debbie told them that John thought he would benefit financially from Debbie's life insurance policy if she died. It was also revealed at trial that John had shot a gun in the apartment just weeks before Debbie's murder as a test to see if anyone would notice the sound, and if any of the neighbors did, what they would do about it. But if any neighbors did hear that gunshot, they never called police, and none of them called the police on the night Debbie was murdered either. On April 4, 1991, John Christopher Smith was convicted of Debbie's second-degree murder. He was sentenced to 15 years to life in prison and had an additional 2 years added for the use of a firearm during his crime. On November 30, 1992, an appeal by John Smith on the basis of ineffective counsel was denied, and the judgment of guilty was upheld. Smith was granted parole in 2017 after serving 26 years in prison. James DiCamara was also sentenced to a shorter amount of time in prison for his role in covering up Debbie's murder. It's unknown what happened to him after he got out, but it appears that he moved to Texas and continued to run into problems with the law. Debbie was just 24 years old when she was murdered in an act of intimate partner violence. something that in 1989 wasn't widely talked about. Her boyfriend, John Christopher Smith, had been controlling, but not enough that anyone in their lives thought that anything was wrong, or that John would ever do anything to harm Debbie. Sonia McClellan, Debbie's youngest sister, pushed for legislation that would teach young people in schools about intimate partner violence, and especially how to spot the warning signs of domestic abuse. With the help of California Assemblyman Jim Frazier, House Bill 643 passed, and in the 2019 school year, students began learning this mandated material in health classes starting in ninth grade. Hopefully, Bill 643 will be something that stands as a monument and testament to honor Debbie's memory and help save future victims. Debbie's other sister, Miles, sat down with me to discuss her sister's tragic and senseless murder. That conversation is coming up in just a moment. Hey everyone, summer's in full swing and a lot of people want to get out and enjoy the sun. But for some of us, that's easier said than done, because all too often, things that have been weighing on us keep us from doing everything that we want to do and living our best lives. But the good news is, there's help, and that help is BetterHelp. If there's something that's interfering with your happiness or preventing you from achieving your goals, then BetterHelp Online Counseling just might be the right solution for you. BetterHelp will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist. You can connect in a safe and private online environment. It's so convenient, and you can start communicating with a counselor in under 24 hours. This isn't self-help, it's professional counseling. Send a message to your counselor at any time. You'll get timely and thoughtful responses. Plus, you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, all without having to sit in an uncomfortable waiting room. BetterHelp can assist you with so many things, from sleep issues, stress, and family conflicts, to help with relationships, anger issues, LGBT matters, and so much more. Anything you share is confidential, and while BetterHelp isn't a crisis line, it is convenient, professional, and affordable. In fact, so many people have been using BetterHelp that they're recruiting additional counselors in all 50 states. I want you to start living a healthier life today. As a listener of The Murder of My Family, you'll get 10% off your first month of BetterHelp by visiting betterhelp.com/family. Join over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health. Once again, go to BetterHelp, that's HELP.com/family, and you'll save 10% on your first month of BetterHelp. One Nefarious Doctor, a hit podcast, and 15 million listeners later, Dr. Death is still making waves all over the world. Dr. Death is the true story of Dr. Christopher Deutsch, a sociopath with a scalpel who left a trail of bodies behind him. Before he was stopped, 33 patients would become paralyzed or die under his care. Now the phenomenon of Dr. Death is being reimagined in a new streaming series starring Alec Baldwin, Anna Sophia Robb, Joshua Jackson, and Christian Slater, exclusively on Peacock. Experience 3 brand new bonus episodes of the Dr. Death podcast where the cast interviews the real-life characters they portray in the streaming series. Golden Globe Award winner Christian Slater sits down with Dr. Kirby, the doctor who finally took Dr. Deutsch down. Anna Sophia Robb talks to Michelle Shugart, the district attorney who put him behind bars. And Dr. Death host and reporter Laura Beale speaks with the full cast about how making the show changed their perspectives on institutions in the medical system. To listen to these new bonus episodes, follow Dr. Death on Amazon Music, Apple Podcast, or you can listen ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app.
I'm Jared Bradley, host of the new podcast, All Things Crime. I've been working with law enforcement, crime labs, criminal attorneys, and other investigative specialists for years, expanding their ability to collect forensics DNA from evidence and use that to solve more crime. Along the way, I've met thousands of professionals who have insights into crime and the investigative process that are beyond fascinating. I've set out to document those insights, give them a voice. In All Things Crime, you'll hear experiences from crime scene investigators, homicide detectives, seasoned patrol officers, defense attorneys, and even some victims, falsely imprisoned, and even criminals. Join us in this amazing journey as we explore, expose, and educate all things crime.
Hi, Miles, and thank you for coming on The Murder of My Family to discuss your sister Debbie's case with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you allowing me the opportunity to share about her.
It's my pleasure, and what I read was horrible doing some of the research in it, and I'm sorry that your family had to go through everything that you did. Debbie's death seemed like it was very tragic, and the details surrounding it obviously are troubling. And we'll certainly talk about all of that. But before we talk about Debbie's death, I'd like to focus, if we can, on her life. Debbie was your older sister. Were you close with her?
Yes. We were 3 years apart. So it was just her and I in the beginning. And then my mother had our younger sister, but she was 10 years younger than me and 13 years younger than Debbie. So it was just the two of us for quite some time.
Did you have that close relationship that a lot of sisters do have?
Absolutely. Yeah. We did a lot of stuff together. We, typical 70s kids, you know, rode your bicycle, ran around in the street till it was dark, played with your neighbors, you know, that type of stuff.
Now, when she got a little bit older, obviously, she got married at a pretty young age. Did that sort of put a little distance between you, or were you still pretty close even after she got married?
Well, it put some distance, only because then I actually went in the service and was stationed in Japan, and that's where I was living when she was actually murdered. So even though there was a physical distance, we were still pretty close, but we didn't necessarily see each other a lot.
Yeah, and then the distance of obviously separate lives, separate careers, whatever you've got going on, and then she had kids and stuff, that probably, like, everyday family situations probably made it a little bit harder to stay in touch as much as you wanted to.
Correct.
If you would, tell us a little bit about Debbie, some of your memories of her.
She was super smart. She skipped a grade, so she graduated high school at 16. She didn't necessarily play any sports or an instrument, but always really wanted to help people. And she loved the color orange. She wanted everything she had to be orange. And she was really an awesome mom.
And how old was she when she got married? 18, is that correct?
Correct. She graduated high school at 16 and she got married at 18. And then shortly thereafter had her daughter, Laura.
And then she had another son. Is that correct?
Correct. She had her son, Gary.
Yeah. And being a new mom, was she excited about that? Was that like a new chapter in her life that she was looking forward to?
Absolutely. She had, my mother was a cosmetologist, but she had gone to school while she was in high school at the local beauty school and became a cosmetologist, but she really didn't like it. So she had just gone back to school. I want to say when she was pregnant, actually, with Laura, and was studying medical office or medical assistant. And when she was murdered, had just started her new career in that.
Did she enjoy that? Was that something that was more suited for her?
Absolutely. Loved helping people. Just, I think, really had her time to shine there.
Yeah, maybe had found her calling and that was something that she was going to pursue.
Correct.
Yeah. And she was married for what, a total of 5 years, and the marriage didn't work out, but she eventually started dating again, and she started a relationship with the man that ultimately ended her life, this John Smith. They eventually moved in together. I know it was a long time ago when you were younger, but do you remember what their relationship was like? And was there anything in their relationship early on that, you know, was a warning sign that there might be problems ahead?
Well, unfortunately, I had never met him because I was living in Japan, but I did know from conversations that I had had with her that he was really trying to control what she did and who she saw and who her friends were. And, you know, if she put something on, he would say it was too sexy, or if she painted her nails, he'd tell her there was no need to, that she, you know, other people didn't need to see her looking that good. And so there were some warning signs that I don't think you really paid attention to. She never told me that he was abusive to her, but I think that he was really trying to just gain control of her. And I don't know if maybe she wasn't aware of it, or if we just didn't know really what the warning signs were.
How long they lived together? How long were they together? Do you know offhand?
I want to say it was almost 2 years. He had also previously been married. He worked at American Airlines as a mechanic. He had gone to college. He didn't have any children, but was divorced when they started dating. So I want to say they were together right about a year and a half, 2 years.
As far as you know, he didn't have any kind of criminal background or a history of violence at all?
Absolutely nothing. No criminal background, no drug abuse, no alcohol abuse. His parents were still together, had siblings, had a beaver cleaver childhood.
In October of 1989, this is, I guess, after about the two-year mark, it seems from what I've read that Debbie was on the verge of leaving him, and then one day she vanished. Can you talk about that part and how your family came to find out she was missing, and what did John have to say about her being gone?
Yep. She had actually phoned my mother and asked if she could come live back at home for a while with the kids because she had made a decision to leave. I'm not honestly certain what triggered that decision on why she felt the relationship was over. Maybe she did catch on to the controlling aspects, or maybe she just wasn't happy, but she had made that decision. So she took her kids to her ex-husband's house, their father, and dropped them off, and was went back to the apartment that she shared with John and was packing up her things. And he came home in the midst of her packing it up, and his story is that he had decided that he was going to leave and that he accidentally had a gun that had discharged and shot her. But his version of what happened was nowhere near what actually happened.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that would come out. And it, not just his version of sort of not knowing that the gun went off, it accidentally went off, but, you know, as we'll find out, he went through great lengths to try and cover up what he did. What did he tell your family and the police when you discovered that she was missing?
So we realized she was missing when her ex-husband called and said she had never come to pick the kids up, which was definitely not her. So we filed the missing persons report, and John claimed that, which is her boyfriend at the time that murdered her, that they had gotten into an argument and she had packed up her stuff and left. He wasn't sure what happened to her. And so he went to work every day like nothing had happened. And he, in the interim, cleaned out the apartment that they had shared and lived in and tossed every personal item she would ever own away. So pictures of her and her kids, pictures of her as a child, all her personal belongings, all her clothing, absolutely everything. Wiped the apartment out and just said that she had moved out and he didn't know what happened. So she remained missing for, I want to say, almost 3 months. And a fishing boat happened to come upon her floating, and that's how we knew what her ultimate demise had been.
Do you know if police were suspicious from him of him early on, and was your family suspicious of him as well?
My mother sort of was. I think my mom probably saw the clues more than anybody else did, but I don't know if police were or not. I know that they did question him, and his whole argument was he just didn't know what happened. They had gotten an argument, and she had packed it up and moved away, and he didn't know where she went or why she wouldn't have got her kids. And he went on like nothing had happened.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like he's very concerned if he's throwing all her stuff out while she's missing and not looking for her.
Well, we didn't know he had thrown it all away because his story was that she had moved out. He disposed of it to go along with his story. So in honesty, the only thing that we have of hers is once all of this came about, he had given some items away in addition to what he had thrown away from the house. And somebody came forward that had a hope chest of hers. And that's the only personal item of hers that we own to this day. And I actually have it. Everything else he either threw away or gave away, and people just didn't ever say anything about. But he didn't throw it away and tell the police he threw it away. He threw it away to pretend she had just moved away.
Oh, just to make it look like she's gone someplace and took all her stuff with her.
Correct.
Wow. And during that time, you found out that her remains were covered. It took a little bit of time, I think, for them to identify her with dental records. How did your family handle that news, and how quickly did it turn from, okay, she's missing, to now she's dead, and you, it's obviously a homicide? How fast did all of that process within your family?
Once she was found, the police department knocked on my mother's door, notified my mother, and then my mother had notified the Red Cross, you notified me, because again, I was in the service in Japan, and my younger sister was just a teenager, so she was still at home with my parents. But I want to say it was a fairly short period of time once they had, the fishermen had discovered her. And part of the reason things started to come together was once he had murdered her, he phoned a friend of his that was a coworker who had come over to help dispose of her. And once the body was found, that coworker went to his HR department at American Airlines, where they had both worked, and basically spilled his whole story, started the investigation motion.
Wow, that's pretty powerful when someone actually comes forward and says they helped dispose of a body. That it's kind of hard to explain that away. When you know, looking back, if he had done that in the first place and gone to his work or the police and said, hey, he tried to get me to help and I wasn't going to have any part of it.
I think the reason he didn't come forward in the beginning was because they truly thought they were going to get away with it. Because once John had shot her, he went to his mother's house and got some. We were originally told it was a transmission that was in the car in her garage. And that's what he wrapped Debbie in a tarp and tied her to this transmission and threw her off the San Mateo Bridge. But it apparently once he shot her, it took a fairly good period of time before she actually passed away. So John had called this friend of his who helped in the end dispose of her. And they ran a bunch of errands for several hours while she had passed away. So had he just phoned, you know, when he showed up there and was like, oh my gosh, there's this woman on the floor that you've just shot and is almost dead, they could have, the theory is, saved her life. But because they chose to just go run a bunch of errands and go get this transmission and do whatever else they were going to do, she obviously perished.
Yeah, that's awful that someone doesn't have a conscience, and you know, you'd think, you would hope someone would do the right thing and come forward and not participate in that. But
he didn't come forward until it came time to save his own hide. Once she was discovered and he knew he was going to jail or facing some serious trouble is the only time he came forward. And he did FaceTime. He served 7 years for the accessory and disposal. His mother, even though he had told his mother that they had shot and killed her, and they went to her house to get the transmission, she didn't face any charges because it was all hearsay. It was just the accomplice saying that that's what happened. So the mother faced no charges, and then obviously John was charged.
Oh, geez. So there's another person that had information that didn't even pay any kind of price. It's sad for your sister to be discarded like someone's throwing trash off a bridge in the river. How tough is that to think that someone had such little regard for her life and left her to suffer until she finally died?
It is heart-wrenching to think that one phone call could have made all the difference. And not necessarily to make a comparison, but to see years later, the Scott Peterson case is pretty much my sister's story just done over. I mean, he took her to the water and disposed of her and pretended she'd run away. And I mean, it unfortunately seems to be a scenario that happens over and over again. And I don't really know what, as a society, we can do to change that.
Yeah, it seems like it's something that's been going on for a long time and probably no end in sight to that kind of thing. How long was it of the process of when she was recovered to them saying, okay, you know, this guy is coming forward now to save his own hide and now he's turning John in? How far was that in process for an arrest and going to court and going to trial and stuff? How long did all of that take?
He had killed her in 1989. She was discovered in October of 89. He had his trial and wasn't sentenced until 91. So there was 1,000 motions to postpone it. There was the defense attorney subpoenaed my parents to make sure that they couldn't attend the trial. So my aunt was actually the only one that was able to attend the trial. So they had a bunch of tactics to make sure that, you know, the jury couldn't see my grieving parents and that no one else in our family could be there to really say if they saw any warning signs or knew of anything that was going on. My aunt ended up having to just attend the whole trial. And then in the end, we just had to order transcripts to even truly find out what had really happened. And that was just his version during the trial, which then, of course, changed 100 times. To the point to where he, you know, had his parole hearings at each one, it would change a little bit.
Yeah, I've never heard of that where someone was barred from being able to attend the trial of someone that's accused of killing their child.
It was just a tactic they used where they subpoenaed them. And if they were subpoenaed, they could not be in the courtroom to hear any of the other testimony because it may skew or alter their testimony if they were in it.
Yeah, it seems like just one more shady thing to try and not give them any kind of justice.
I agree. The justice system doesn't seem very just when you're on the receiving end of a crime.
Sure, and obviously there's no such thing as closure in this kind of case. But some kind of healing, some kind of end of a process to move on to the next chapter. It seems like they stalled that and delayed that for your family.
They did. Once he was finally sentenced in 91, he was found guilty of second degree murder, which we never understood because it had come out that he had knew she was planning to leave because he had gone to a friend's house and crouched outside a window and heard her making these plans. My mom, it had come out. He seemed to do whatever he can to get away with as little sentence as he could. And then once he was convicted, he did everything that he could to try to manipulate the system to get out. So when he first was put in, he was nothing but trouble. So he did some time in Pelican Bay, he did some time in San Quentin, and then he caught on that if he was a good boy, that he would be able to work his way out of the system, which is what he ended up doing. His sentence for his second degree conviction was 17 years to a life sentence. So he was considered a lifer at the prison. He was eligible for parole right about his 10th year. And then the maximum amount of time they could deny a parole is 3 years. So the first 4 times that he went up for his parole hearing, he was denied for a full 3-year term. Only twice did he actually have to wait the 3 years. After that, he would appeal that 3-year sentence and get in a new appeal or parole date at roughly the year and a half mark. So I actually lived in Pennsylvania, and this all took place in California. So we would have to fly back and go to these parole hearings and do all of this preparation to get petitions and letters and things to keep him there, or to try to fight to keep him there. And again, nothing was made easy for the victim or the victim's family. So he ended up serving a total of 26, 28 years. I don't remember off the top of my head. Until he was finally granted parole in 2018.
You know, again, you mentioned it, second degree. It sounds like a first degree case. And you, the fact that he went to great measures to try and cover up what he did. It's mind boggling that he didn't get a first degree sentence and that he's free now. I mean, your sister had her whole life out of her and he did such little time. You know, obviously the justice system is not perfect, but, you know, sometimes you just have to scratch your head and say, what happened here? And this sounds like one of those cases.
Yeah, you get a longer sentence for drug conviction than you would for a murder conviction, which is just crazy to me.
Yeah, I just, it's unfortunate, and it's something we hear about too often. Again, nothing would bring your sister back, but just knowing that the person that is responsible is away and not going to harm anyone else. Seems like it would be some kind of comfort, but here he is out, and it's a real shame.
Well, and apparently part of the reason he got out and part of the reason that he got granted parole this last time is in the state of California, the law that was passed that if you committed a crime prior to the age of 26, your brain had fully not developed. So he got yet another opportunity for a parole hearing. And at that hearing, once he knew the law, his argument was that, you know, he was just this immaturely formed brain and he didn't know what he was doing and wasn't really sure what the consequences were. And so I'm sure at that point from the prior parole hearings where he had learned to skew his story a little more towards the truth, that he was never going to get out unless he was somewhat truthful. Between the combination of the two, I think that's what led to his release.
Yeah, he claims that he didn't know what he was doing and that the difference between right and wrong, yet he went through all those lengths to try and cover up what he did.
Exactly. And he had all the opportunity. Like, if he had honestly just gotten in a fight with her and shot her and she was lying on the floor still breathing and not dead, and apparently for hours, why at some point would you not look at this human being and say, oh my God, what have I done? Let me call the ambulance. You know, none of that ever took place, which is what we kind of can't wrap our head around. It's not like he was on drugs. It's not like he did alcohol. It's not like he was uneducated or had a, you know, abusive childhood. There was zero things to point that he would do something like that, and especially to the magnitude that he did it.
Yeah. And we hear a lot of cases where there's a lot of warning signs, and then we hear other ones where, you know, the background of the person is just clean. There's nothing there that lets you know that one day something like this is going to happen.
Right.
Did he ever show any kind of remorse or apologize at all to your family?
He, after the third parole hearing, did write a letter and ask if he could communicate with us and apologize. And we declined that. Only because we had learned through prior parole hearings that he had caught on to what was needed. He needed family forgiveness. He needed to be honest about what happened. He needed to have found God, and he needed to pretend to be remorseful. So we figured if we allowed him to apologize, it was just one more thing that he could take to his parole hearing and say, look, the family forgives me. You should let me out. We fought every way we could to keep him in there.
Yeah. And it sounds like it was just one more thing in his book of tricks to try and take care of number one.
Correct.
And I know, as horrible as this is, that as a result, something positive happened in the state of California that's helping other people. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. My younger sister still resided in California. And like I said, she was probably 14 when my sister was killed. So she obviously is older now and had a lot of questions about why John had killed Debbie and what had happened, and it didn't really click for her. So once she was married and had children, she started to do a little research and come to find out her children were not getting any sort of education at school, only through their parents, if their parents knew enough to warn them about what a healthy relationship looks like and what an unhealthy relationship looks like, whether it's mental abuse or physical abuse or sexual abuse. So she worked with the assemblymen in California and got a bill passed that requires all public schools in the state of California in their health class in eighth grade to provide some sort of relationship education about what a healthy relationship is and what an unhealthy relationship is. And it was done in partnership with a domestic violence organization called Laura's House. So there is now a bill, thanks to Debbie and my younger sister's efforts, to make sure that hopefully nobody faces the same consequences that she did for, you know, not knowing enough.
Yeah. And something like that is something that I don't think we can talk about enough to help other people that are younger or maybe going to experience that kind of stuff. And that sounds like a wonderful way to honor your sister's memories to have something like that.
Yeah. We are very, even where I live, we are very involved in domestic education, domestic violence education, and really trying to hope and help other women not to face the same end result.
That's admirable, and I hope that maybe other people will expand on that and maybe figure out a way to make that even better and reach more people.
Yeah, we tried to do the same thing in Pennsylvania where I am a resident, and we had that education already. So it was something that Sonia, which is our younger sister, you know, could really do, because there was not that education in California where Debbie was and where she still lives.
It's coming up now, what, on 32 years without your sister. I can only imagine how horrible it's been not having her in your life, not being able to share experiences and milestones and things like that. And I can't even imagine how hard it's been on your niece and nephew. How has this affected them? I mean, they're adults now, but how have they dealt with this over the years?
This is the heartbreaking part. I mean, they have no idea how great their mother was and how much she loves them. And to have missed her, seeing her children grow up and have children of their own and get married, and, you know, for me to grow up even and have my own children, and now I have a grandson, and know that these are milestones that we would have really shared together. It's heartbreaking. I mean, her children did okay. Her son Gary ended up going into the service, and he served 8 years in the Army and got married and has a son, and got out of the service and is back in California. And her daughter is married and has two daughters. And they were very lucky in that they ended up with their biological father, and he married a lady that he had stayed married to for quite some time. So she was a great parental role model for them. They call her mom, and she's still involved in their lives, even though that relationship with their father ultimately didn't last. So they did have some good influences and, you know, turned out okay. But I think a lot of it was they went to a lot of counseling when they were younger. We made sure we still talked about Debbie and what happened. We've all stayed connected and involved in their lives, even though their father really didn't have to keep them tied to us at all. So the heartbreaking part is really just knowing how proud she would have been and all of the things she's missed out on.
And you look back now, What do you think Debbie's legacy is or should be, or when people think of her, what do you want them to remember her for?
I want them to remember that she had such a big heart and such a desire to help other people, and what a great mom she really was. It really breaks my heart that her kids will never know, because they were so young when she was killed, that they will never know how much she loved them and what a great mom she was. And the fact that there's this bill that if it changes one person's outcome, makes me so proud that she is that legacy.
And that's the unfortunate part of these kinds of cases, that there's a ripple effect that a person that's murdered, they're gone, but then everyone connected to them, their lives change too, and usually not for the better. But hopefully this law that's in place because of Debbie, hopefully that is going to help someone's life. You said if it's just one person, then that's going to give you some comfort. So that's something good we can take away from the tragedy. I do want to thank you for coming on and sharing Debbie's story and for opening up about how this has affected you and your family over the past three decades.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me share it. And, you know, I just hope that we come up with a better way to handle our justice system. I mean, I'm thankful for it, and that, again, he served over 20 years, and like you said, three decades, but just that there's so many things that you don't know. Like, even to go to a parole hearing, there's a hierarchy of who can go. There's a rule of how many people can attend. There's, you know, the whole hearing part and all of the postponements and subpoenaing my parents so they couldn't go. There's just all these quirks that, like that, affect your family in so many ways that you would have no idea. Like, you would think that the justice system would just wrap their arms around you, and it's so hard to navigate that that's not what happens.
Yeah, and I'm sure there's no kind of manual or anything for this. This was something you all had to experience on the fly.
Correct.
Well, again, I appreciate you for opening up and sharing Debbie's story with us. And I'm glad to hear that her children are doing as well as can be expected after something like this happened to them and being robbed of their time with their mother.
Yeah, that definitely is a blessing that they are doing well. I know that her daughter had some struggles in the beginning, but I do think that her dad really tried to do the best that he could with getting her the help that she would need and a role model that would help her.
Thank you once again for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'd like to thank Sonny Landon for writing and research assistance in this episode. As we wrap up, I'd like to play a preview for a true crime podcast. It's called Crime Divers. Be sure to give it a listen. We'll be back here soon with an all-new episode of The Murder of My Family, and I hope you'll join me for it. But before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.
Are you fascinated by true crime like us?
If so, check out our podcast, Crime Divers, hosted by me, Jill.
And me, Laura.
Look out for new episodes every Tuesday when we discuss true crime from around the world.
So what are you waiting for? Come join us as we dive in.